All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to begin. My name is John Peat. I'm the Europe editor of The Economist, and it's my pleasure to chair this debate. Thank you for coming, despite the tube strike, and also despite the fact that, I'm sorry to say, Sir Menzies Campbell, Ming Campbell, had to pull out this afternoon. But you still have a very distinguished panel of four people to discuss the European parliamentary elections, what's at stake. As we get a bit closer, I guess more people are focusing on these elections. They're attracting, I believe, rather more publicity, certainly in this country, than they did last time round. Mainly, I have to say, because of the rise of UKIP. But even in some other European countries, I think they are attracting more attention. We are told in our handout that 390 million Europeans will be invited to go to the polls. Of course, one of the problems about the European elections is quite a lot of people will not go to the polls. The turnout last time was 43%, which was the lowest since 1979, and I've spoken to people who expect this one to be not much more than that, despite the slightly greater press interest, and despite also the fact that these elections, some people think, are going to play a role in the choice of the next European Commission president. I hope we will hear more about that during the discussion, as well as about the rise of populist parties and the impact that populist parties, if I can use that phrase, will have, not just in the European Parliament, but on national governments. We're going to start with Sarah Hageman, assistant professor here and co-founder of Vote Watch Europe, because she has some really new results from Vote Watch Europe, which is a group, well, you'll tell us about it. It's a group watching the election and polling in all 28 countries in the European Union. Then Stuart Wheeler, treasurer of UKIP and a former member of the Conservative Party, will follow. Then we will have Maurice Fraser, who you all know, the head of the European Institute here at LSE, and we'll finish with Mark Leonard, the director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. And each speaker will speak for between 7 and 10 minutes, and then we'll throw it open for debate. So, Sarah, we'll begin with you.
Thank you very much. I'll try very quickly to find the latest results, which, as you already mentioned, John, are the product of project by Vote Watch, a transparency organization based in Brussels, and colleagues here at LSE, especially Simon Higgs. So what the Poll Watch project is about is basically looking at all of the 28 member states and national polls from these member states, and on a weekly basis we update what are the predictions in terms of the seat allocation and relative powers of each of the parties across Europe. So many of you will know that in the current parliament we have this spread of seats, with the two main parties, the EPP party group, dominating with 275 seats, and the socialist group of 195. We then have the ALDE group, the Liberals, in the middle with 85. We have the Greens with 58. The European Conservative Party group, which mainly also consists of the UK Conservatives, and then we have the more fringe parties. The big change we are seeing at the moment in the polls is basically that we will still have a very centred European Parliament after the next elections if these polls are to be followed. But we will see quite a sharp decline for the EPP group, so they will still lead with 213, but be closely followed by the socialists with 208. The ALDE group in the middle, however, is standing to lose at least 23 seats, so that will go down to 62. The Greens will also be squeezed, and then we see that the groups on the more extreme positions, as well as independents, are basically going up. In particular, you should pay attention to the 97 independents that we see on the far right. Of course, that's a very mixed group of people at the moment, and we are still to see if that will actually lead to new party groups. But this is the prediction right now, that we will see more of a squeezed middle and more representation on the fringes. And so, of course, we need to be very careful with the interpretation of opinion polls. We always know that there is some bias in some countries. We know that there's a consistent bias in, for example, Western Europe compared to Eastern Europe. And we've tried to correct for some of these things in these numbers. But still, I won't stand here and say that this is exactly the makeup we will have in the next parliament, but the general balance is possibly quite accurate, of a squeezed middle and more French representation. Now, there are very divided opinions about whether or not this really matters. Because of the way politics are conducted in the European Parliament, we have supermajority requirements on a lot of legislation, so therefore we always need to see majorities form across the middle, and we will see that in the next parliament again. So we've done a comparison of like the most important pieces of legislation we've seen in this parliament and whether this new makeup would make a difference to the outcomes. And it doesn't quite seem like that. But on the other hand, the legislative agenda that we see for the next parliament will have some very significant issues, such as TTIP, the free trade agreement with the US, will have issues on free movement, will have issues regarding to the EU budget, where the parliament has increased powers, and a number of very essential EU legislative issues where the parliament now has real power, and where some of these pieces of legislation might actually find difficulty in being passed in the parliament just with the centre support. So we might see some implications in terms of the legislative activity in the parliament. I won't go into much more detail on all of this right now, but I think that I just want to make one other point, which is that a lot of people would criticise the parliament as this second-order nature, which is, of course, true. Everything takes place in the national context. But one thing that I find is very often overlooked in this debate is that apart from the legislative activity of the parliament, we have a number of very important decisions coming at the EU level. So the parliament might not have a legislative power in those issues, but they will certainly have the power to scrutinize and debate in the same way as we have it in national parliaments. And I think that here we need to take into account that the new profile of the politicians coming in will certainly have an impact also on this kind of scrutiny position of the power. I think that there's a lot to be said about also the makeup that we can expect also in the UK situation and what implication it has for national parliaments. But I think, you know, there are many issues to point out here. I just wanted to give first an overview and then perhaps dive into some of these topics in more detail afterwards.
Great. Thank you. Stuart Wheeler.
Good evening, everybody. I was very flattered to be asked to take part in this event, but now that I see who else is taking part, I feel I've rather stepped into the lion's den, as I think everybody else on the panel is a Europhile, and even our chairman has been known to express Europhile views. But never mind, we UKIPers are used to being up against it, so I'll do the best I can. Now, what I was told this was going to be partly about was whether we should be worried about the possible results of the elections and the possibility of a self-hating parliament. Well, I don't need to tell you that if we get a self-hating parliament, will not be in any way worried. We shall be delighted, and we shall hope that they hate themselves enough to vote for their own disbandment. But I don't think I can be quite as optimistic as that. Now, I'm going to deal first and very quickly with why UKIP thinks we should leave the EU, and then with what is likely to happen on the 22nd of May and what will be the consequences of that. Now, first, I'm the treasurer of UKIP, so I think about money matters, including money matters of the United Kingdom, and so I come to cost. Now, Tim Congdon, who was one of the wise men some years ago, Professor Tim Congdon, has brought out far the most thoroughly researched analysis of what it does cost us to be in, and I've got several copies, and you can have one at the end if you like. But he has come out fairly recently with the fact that it costs, or the opinion, that it costs us 165 billion, not million, 165 billion pounds a year to be members of the EU. Now, just to put that into language which is easier to understand, that is £2,500 for every man, woman, child and baby in this country. And so if Professor Congdon is anywhere near right, the benefits, whatever they are, for being in the EU are going to need to be absolutely colossal to justify it. Next point, give us back our country. In this country, we've been ruling ourselves rather successful, for goodness knows successfully, how many centuries. And I think most people in this country would like us to go on doing so, instead of which now over half our laws are made in Brussels. And I think a lot of people in this country would like to see us governing ourselves. Then regulations. They affect any business or anyone who carries on any business in this country. My wife has a horse business. She has stables. And she was rather horrified a few years ago, never having any interest really in the European Union, to find that the laws about what she could do with her manure were really very, very tiresome indeed. And so for the first time she took an interest when I told her that they came straight, as they did, from Brussels. That's quite amusing. But the effect that these regulations have on small businesses is absolutely awful. They make them so difficult to run that many small businesses just stop trying. They don't have that effect on big businesses, because big businesses can afford the people to make sure they're doing the right thing, and they also have the compensation of knowing that a lot of their potential small businesses who might compete with them really can't do it. So they're much more relaxed about it. Then there's a European arrest warrant. Many of our people can be plucked off overseas, charged with what in this country might not even be a crime, left in an unpleasant prison for months before being tried over there, and we think we should get rid of that. Then there's a common agricultural policy, common fisheries policy. I won't go into too much detail on those, you'll know all about them. Especially the common fisheries policy has really more or less destroyed our fishing industry. So that's another disadvantage. Now, the advantage of being in the European Union, so the Europhiles would tell you, is that it'll cost us 3 million jobs if we have to leave. But this is, as Lord Lawson recently pointed out, absolute rubbish. It's based on the idea that because we buy a lot from, well, we sell a lot to Europe, and 3 million people need it to make what we sell, that we'll stop doing business with them, and that'll cost 3 million jobs. Well, I don't know if you know, but we sold £89 billion less to them last year than they sold to us, £89 billion. Now, do you really think that the Europeans, if we leave, will be so upset and annoyed that they would stop trading with us? It's absolutely clear that that would not happen. And this is a myth, but actually from UKIP's point of view, it's an important one, because it is stated against us so often that if you say something over and over and over again, people begin to believe it. So one of our tasks is to try to get over that. Now, uncontrolled immigration. Our policy on immigration is, I believe, entirely right. If anyone wants to come here because they're in danger of torture or forced imprisonment if they're sent back to their own country, of course they can come. If they want to come here and work and we need their skills, yes, of course they can come. If they want to come and live here but not work because it's a nice place to live, we agree that it's a nice place to live. They're quite right, but unfortunately we just don't have room. We are half the size of France, but we have the same population, just to give you one example. Now, there is one tricky area. What about people with low skills who are willing, nevertheless, to come here for wages which are less than are current here at the moment and might take the jobs of people here? That might be an advantage to business, slightly lower costs and possibly, in some cases, workers who would work harder. But UKIP's point of view is that our main duty is to the people who live in this country, and so we say in such circumstances, no, you can't come. Now, my daughters, I have three daughters, they often say to me, Daddy, you've got all these reasons why we ought to leave the EU. But a lot of very clever people think that we ought to stay in. They must have a point, my daughters say. Can you explain to me, Daddy, what the point is? And I have to say, I'm terribly sorry, darling, I can't. But luckily, we've got other people in this debate, and they will have to explain that for you, because it is very difficult for us in UKIP to see what the point is. Of course, we want to cooperate with the other 27 members of the EU, and of course we will, and of course we want to be on good terms with them, but we don't need to be bossed about, as we see it, by the European Commission. Right, that's enough about why we should get out. Now, what's going to happen on the 22nd of May? Well, of course, we don't know. And we're certainly not triumphalist about it. The Sunday Times gave us 31% last Sunday, again 28% for Labour, and I think 19% for the Conservatives. But that's not a certainty. We may not make it. On the other hand, people who support a radical party, and we are radical, do tend to vote more determinedly than supporters of other parties. So I think our chances are pretty good, but no certainty. Now, what will happen if we do win? What will happen to the leaders of the other parties? Well, in Cameron's case, if he really comes a bad third, I think he is in some danger of being chucked out. A very, very senior member of the Tory party, I don't think it would be fair to name him, with whom I had lunch about a month ago, said that he thought that in those circumstances there would be about a 20% chance that Cameron would be chucked out. But he would be awfully close to the next election. Miliband, I don't think he would be chucked out, but what we UKIPers hope is that he would then be persuaded by our potential victory that if he doesn't give us a referendum and really pretty well cast down, to use an overused word, promise, then he might lose the election. And no doubt he wants to win the election. And so that, from our point of view at least, would be a hugely beneficial result of our getting a big majority. Now, as to Clegg, I'm really not sure what he thinks, but much the same might, I think, apply to him. What after that? Could there be a pact? I'm constantly asked, why don't you... Well, it's not me, but why doesn't UKIP do a pact with the Conservatives? After all, UKIP actually stands for lots of things which the Conservatives, when they were Conservative, did stand for. So in many, many ways, we stand for the same thing. One of the problems would be that Cameron himself, assuming he's still the leader, might find it difficult. He's been so scathing about whatever the words he used, about us, whatever the words he used, closet racists, etc., etc., that it might be a little bit difficult to make peace. But politics is about power, so a week is a long time in politics too, so I would not completely rule out some kind of thing happening, but certainly not before the 22nd of May. So that's how it stands as I see it. When it comes to questions, I'm sorry to tell you, I am really quite deaf, and so the question may have to be repeated by the chair if I'm unable to hear it. Thank you very much.
Or indeed, I might be able to give the answer. Maurice Fraser.
Well, I don't think the results in themselves are going to tell us all that much about the future direction of the European Union. Of course, the surge of Eurosceptic nationalist and populist parties will be a big media story for a while. And I'm not suggesting that, I certainly don't mean to suggest that a Eurosceptic surge has been entirely discounted by the media. The media will still have fun with that. But by definition, the true significance of the EP elections and of the predicted Eurosceptic surge, if that is a surge of that materializes, will only be discerned when we see how Europe's governments and main political formations react to it. After the initial rhetoric that I think we can already anticipate, we've been sent the elites, the governing classes, governments have been sent a wake-up call. We have to listen to the people. The European project must reconnect with the citizens, and et cetera, and we know the script. But it seems to me that just as important a news headline as a predicted surge by nationalist and populist parties will be the turnout. Now, these elections will be... they'll be the first test of the so-called politicization thesis, the idea that European politics can be, or politics at EU level, can be brought to life and the EU, by extension, legitimized by organizing around traditional left-right categories that voters can recognize and which have the ability to mobilize them. Now, of course, these elections are not the same as elections directly to elect the president of the European Commission. We're not there yet. But they are certainly new. They are novel in the sense that each political family will be making clear who their candidate for president of the European Commission is. So it will be a first opportunity to test the assumption amongst many political scientists and within the Brussels beltway that more politics is the answer to the democratic deficit. Well, I, for one, am not holding my breath. Some will argue that even if the turnout increase goes up a little bit from 43%, well, considering the trend has all been one direction since 1979, that in itself would be an achievement, but I think that would be pretty paltry stuff. Now, if the predicted anti-EU surge materializes, these elections, I think, will pose a pretty existential challenge to centre-left and centre-right parties, who will have to decide whether they want to remain broadly camped on a sort of liberal centre ground of support for the single market, and broadly speaking, I emphasize the broad because it's not always entirely the case, but broadly speaking, free global trade, structural reform being a good thing, fiscal consolidation being regrettable but probably necessary, or whether they want to revert to their more sort of broad church mission since the Second World War, spanning from on the left, from social democracy to what might one call a more socialist program, such as the French Socialist Party continues to espouse, and on the right, spanning from a broadly liberal social market view of the world to something more nationalist and Pujadist and indeed protectionist. And of course, we find protectionism on the left wrapped in the rhetoric of anti-globalization. Mind you, we hear anti-globalization rhetoric from Marine Le Pen as well. So we will soon see whether this broadly centrist, EPP, liberal, sort of centre-left, part of European socialist consensus is opening up space, a serious space on the far left and the far right, for more populist parties to use the EP, to use the Parliament, if nothing else, as a megaphone into their own national politics. So how will the mainstream parties react to this? Or how are they faced with this? What I'm suggesting is not far short of an existential choice. How will they react to this? Well, I think the initial reaction, I mean, this, how long is a piece of string? But I think within what one might plausibly anticipate in the short term is that the voices within the mainstream parties, certainly on the centre-left, for easing up a little bit on austerity will probably be strengthened, but I doubt this is going to bring about a sea change in the overall economic strategy across Europe. And has been notable so far, anyway, the moderate anti-austerity lobby, more notable for its sort of tone and inflection than for its analysis, which it doesn't, and which it doesn't disagree fundamentally from the centre-right. On the centre-right, I think a strong showing by anti-EU parties will probably lead to calls for more subsidiarity, and even some repatriation of powers, such as we hear increasingly from German Christian Democrats, for example, particularly the CSU, but also the CDU, but also we hear in the Netherlands and elsewhere. I think that as far as the supply side generally, sorry, forgive the technical jargon, but the supply side of the economy goes, as opposed to macroeconomic consolidation, as far as the supply side goes, a strong far left and far right showing will make the European Parliament a very unreliable ally for the cause of structural reform in Europe, leaving that job mostly to EPP affiliated parties, a probably much reduced liberal rump, such as Sarah has pointing out, seems to be being foretold in the polls. Scandinavian Social Democrats to an extent, and maybe even Mr. Renzi. But is that a strong enough coalition for a reform agenda in Europe based on competitiveness and completing the single market of the kind which David Cameron and also many other governments, not only North European governments, but a lot of other European governments would like to see? Will the Parliament be in a position to shape the overall direction of policy in the EU? And not just by being an occasional veto player on specific items of legislation, which might be quite important, and which Sarah quite rightly alerted us to, but in a more broader strategic sense. Well, if aligning the political stripe, the political colour of the European Parliament and the new Commission President could bring about a serious alliance of the Commission and the Parliament, going beyond what has become an increasingly symbiotic relationship between the two institutions, we would have the makings of a pretty unstoppable coalition, which would have the Council and the new Mr. Rompuy quaking. But I personally doubt this will happen. First, because the Parliament is going to be even more fragmented than before. Second, because it's by no means clear that the end result of what will be a very complex negotiation, which tries to reconcile the interests not only of left and right, but of the northern and southern European members, between large and small member states, and tries to achieve a certain gender balance in the top jobs as well. It's not clear that that kind of negotiation is going to lead to that ideological alignment of Parliament and Commission, which, as I suggested, could be a pretty unstoppable combination. And that's whatever the Lisbon Treaty says. The wording of the treaty is actually really quite vague and ambiguous, because it says that the president of the new president of the Commission will be selected on taking into account the European Parliament elections. It doesn't actually say, I mean, this is angels and pinheads territory, but it doesn't actually say the results even of the European Parliament elections, just taking account of the European of the elections. Well, I mean, it can be taken to me just about anything. Anyway, my own view is that certainly it will be a pity if the main impact of the European Parliament elections will turn out to be that it has struck a blow against markets, because markets have been right at the centre of the European project since, of course, since the Treaty of Rome. And I don't just mean striking a symbolic blow. The European Parliament support will, of course, be needed for any further deepening of the single market, for TTIP, a transatlantic trade treaty, as Sarah suggested. So it will be potentially we could see a European Parliament which is deeply inimical to the whole thrust of what the European project has been about since the 1950s. My own view is that it would be a shame if megaphone politics, or what others perhaps less technocratically inclined than me would call democratic politics, distracts the European Parliament from the role that it's actually been performing increasingly well and largely unnoticed. That is the role of an expert revising chamber, such as we think of our House of Lords, with a lot of knowledge and expertise in a lot of sectors, and that is work that is quiet and sort of rather unglamorous work, which gets little attention and which certainly doesn't get people flocking to the. I doubt we'll be getting them flocking to the polls, but that seems to me a pity. But anyway, that's neither here nor there, my own view on this. But I'm sure that once again the technocrat in me gets the better of the democrat. But I think that would be a pity, because it's an unsung virtue of the Parliament, and I don't think there's going to be much attention on that in the next few months, and probably years. Anyway, thank you.
I'm glad to hear the European Parliament is good for something. Mark Leonard.
So I was going to spend most of my time talking about a paper that we've just published at ECFR on the Eurosceptic surge and how to respond to it, but maybe before I go into that and what's going to happen into the European elections, I would like to just very briefly answer some of the points that Stuart Wheeler made about whether Britain benefits from being in Europe, and some of the arguments that he made about why British people might not think that they benefit from their membership of the EU. And I think what was interesting about everything he said, and the subliminal question which is behind people, which is in people's mind when they answer questions about whether they want to be in or outside of the European Union in Britain, is that the question is the European Union perfect? Is it great? Is it the union of our dreams? And it would be an incredible person who answered yes to that in the middle of the worst economic and financial crisis that the West has been through in generations, when there is high unemployment across the European Union, when there are all sorts of problems that we're dealing with, and we're also living through a massive geopolitical crisis, and not necessarily doing such a brilliant job of living up to that. But what we also know is that when there is a referendum, if there is a referendum in this country about staying or in the European Union or leaving, it will be a different question that we're answering. The question will not be between the Britain of our dreams and the European Union that we live in at the moment. The question will be between whether Britain will have a better future trying to improve the European Union and help it deal with the crises that we're facing in the world, or whether we could chart another course for ourselves. And what's interesting about the Eurosceptic arguments is that they never really talk about what the alternative is that they're advocating. Is it to go down the path that Norway and Switzerland have gone down, which is essentially to accept all of the common standards which are developed by the European Union member states but not have a vote on them? Is it to go down the path that Turkey has gone down, which is to have a customs union with the European Union, which would not even give us full access to the single market? Or is it just to join the WTO and have the same sort of relationship with the European Union that Vietnam or Laos has with the EU itself? And the other thing which I think is lies behind it is a kind of bogus sense that the benign global conditions that we've lived through over the last couple of decades, where many people benefited from global trade, will continue as they have done in the past. But I think what is also becoming clear is that the era of Western-led globalization is fast coming to an end. Within the next few years, China will emerge as the largest economy in the world, and Chinese-led globalization is going to be a very different thing from American-led globalization. The central economy in the global economy will be a state capitalist economy, a country with over a billion citizens. It will be the biggest market in the world, and they've already shown in their relations with their neighbors that they're not afraid to use their raw economic power to dictate the terms of trade with people who with whom they do business. So the question really is, as a country with 60 million citizens, how are we going to best deal with this world of continental blocks where different people have different values, different economic systems, and are trying to create a global economy that works in their interests? Do we want to face them alone as a small country with a 15th of their population, or do we want to face them as part of a global trading bloc with whom we don't share necessarily a language or all of our different values, but with whom we have much more in common than we do with the great emerging powers of tomorrow, whether it's China or India or Russia or Brazil? And in that context, I think there are four powerful arguments for staying within the European Union. The first is about growth and innovation and about how we can reform the European Union so that it provides a platform for British jobs in this sort of in this world of China-led globalization. Secondly, there's the question of self-government. How do we make sure that it's us who decide what standards dictate how our companies do business? The idea that Stuart mentioned is that we suffer because of the red tape that comes from Brussels. I personally would be much happier with the red tape from Brussels made by our ministers, by British commissioners, much of it, and which is passed by our parliament, rather than having the red tape that comes from Beijing, which is what we'll have to contend with if we live in a world of China-led globalisation. Thirdly, there is this question of social protection. I think that it is wrong for our Europe debate in Britain to be a subsection of the debate about migration, which is what it has been in recent times. But I do think that the questions which people are raising are real questions, and that it's no good for pro-Europeans simply to shrug and to tell them that the economy as a whole benefits from migration, and that EU migrants are net contributors to our economy. That is obviously true. But the lived experience of many people across the country is that whilst migration might bring economic benefits, it does put pressure on public services in particular sectors, it drives out housing prices, and there are other issues which people have to live with and which need to be dealt with. But the solution isn't to destroy our economy and to destroy our hope of shaping the future of our country. The solution is to think about how we can reform the EU budget so that it helps support areas which are large recipients of net migration, and to tighten up on the policies which would encourage people to the very small number of people who travel not to work but to abuse the benefit system. And the fourth kind of set of reasons why we need to be in Europe is because so many of the questions of tomorrow are going to be questions which have to be resolved at the scale of continents. Whether it's dealing with big data and protecting our privacy from the NSA and from other global snoopers, whether it's dealing with climate change and protecting ourselves from the massive emitters like China and the United States that are destroying our environment, or whether it's dealing with Russian aggression in our continent. The idea that we're better off dealing with those big problems on our own rather than part of a community of half a billion people, a community of people who, with whom we share so much cultural history, experience, where we go on holiday, and where you have many ties that bind us together, even if we enjoy, you know, fighting each other on the football pitch and making fun of each other in our comedy series. The differences that between us and the French and the Germans and other issues are. What Freud called the narcissism of small differences. If you compare it to the difference in our political, economic system and our basic interests with other parts of the world. Anyway, that's not what I was going to talk about, but I felt that it would be a shame if we got to the end of the panel without anyone engaging with the arguments that Stuart had made. But I probably used most of my time on it, so maybe... So all of it? Is there any time to talk about the European elections?
Be brief.
Okay. What I was going to talk about was this whole question of the European elections and what will happen as a result of these elections. And I was going to engage with some of the issues that Sarah and Maurice and Stuart dealt with, which is essentially whether these elections are going to be different from normal European elections, which are sort of low stakes, low turnout, and generally outside of the Rond-Point Schuman and the Place Luxembourg, make relatively sort of light impact on consciousness of most Europeans. The people in those institutions tell us it will be different this time because rather than having the normal debate of more versus yet less Europe, this will be a left-right election where the people who go to the polls will decide whether Martin Schulz from the Socialist Group or Jean-Claude Juncker emerge as the President of the European Commission. I think actually, paradoxically, both unlikely that either of them will emerge as the President of the European Commission, and in the questions and answers I can explain why, but also that actually the very way that this election has been framed has made it more of an election about more versus less Europe than any election that we've had beforehand. And we'll see what happens in the exact when people go to the polls. But I think if you look at Sarah's chart, there is a non-negligible possibility that the biggest group of MEPs that's elected, bigger than the Socialists or the EPP group, will be the group of people who don't want the European Union to exist, and that we will see some variant of the self-hating Parliament, which Stuart Wheeler was talking about before emerging. Will that matter? Well, superficially, I don't think it... On the one hand, it can matter within the EU system because they can block the appointment of the President of the Commission, they can veto legislation in lots of different areas, and Sarah mentioned some of the areas where you might see a big shift, whether it's on free movement of labour, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership and other areas. There is talk about them becoming a sort of European Tea Party that tries to block legislation and grind the functioning of the EU institutions to a halt. Actually, luckily, the European Union doesn't really have the power to... The European Parliament doesn't have the power to do what the Tea Party could do to the US Congress. But I think that there are two other possible things that will come out of these elections which are more worrying. I think a more worrying outcome is that the emergence and the surge of these anti-establishment parties will force the mainstream parties to work together more closely in a kind of Europe cartel to protect business as usual, not just in Brussels, which happens anyway because of the voting rules on most issues, where there is a de facto grand coalition between the left and the right, but increasingly at a national level as well. And if you look at the political map of Europe, you see grand coalitions in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Finland, in Austria, in Greece, in Italy, in many countries, you have all of the mainstream establishment parties huddling together in the centre, protecting themselves from the anti-establishment parties on the outside. And I think that that is one of the most damaging things that's happening to European politics, is rather than having a choice between different visions of Europe, there is a danger that you have a Europe cartel that protects a European Union that isn't working particularly well, that needs to be reformed in a dramatic way to work better, and actually does the work of the Eurosceptics by defending the indefensible rather than actually charting out some clear alternatives and allowing a real battle of ideas to emerge amongst the pro-Europeans. If I had more time, I would explain how that could work and go into more details, but hopefully in the questions and answers I can deal with some of those things afterwards.
Well, thank you, Mark. I think, as you pointed out, we have ranged some way from European parliamentary elections, what's at stake. But I guess that you could interpret that as meaning, well, what's at stake and what's the future of Europe? So, yes, we've had rather a lot of debate, which I hope we won't continue with for too long, about the place of the UK in the EU. We've got about 40 minutes for comments and questions. I'm going to pick up right towards the end of what Mark was saying by asking Maurice, who hasn't really mentioned this question, if we get the result behind us, do you think that means we are bound to have President Jean-Claude Juncker at the Commission?
Well, as I think I suggested, John, I'm not very good at thinking spatially, so when confronted with scenarios that look, what I'm told, look quite similar to multi-level chess, I take cover. Given the fragmentation of the Parliament, and given, as I suggest, the need to reconcile several different requirements in the course of these negotiations, we're talking, of course, about presidency of the European Commission, but especially in the context of the European Parliament elections. But there will be a new president of the European Council. There will be a new High Representative for Foreign Affairs after Cathy Ashton. And some other and other jobs which are not completely unrelated, which are likely to come into the equation to an extent. New sort of Eurozone head, Secretary General of NATO.
Yeah, that's done,
isn't it? That is done. You're quite right. Stoltenberg. That's right. Exactly. But anyway, a number of jobs, and there will have. There will be. I think that there must be one job will have to be for a woman, possibly more. But so that's one thing to. I mean, that will have to be balanced with the election results. There will be. I think that the Meds would be up in arms and would be sending the wrong sort of signal for a European Union which is trying to achieve more solidarity. If it just looked as though the northern states, the large states, and France don't always agree, ganging up and just leaving the southern countries. Out. And there's the small and large dimension as well, the small member states and the large member states. So trying to reconcile all these interests is going to be fearfully difficult. I don't see a large number of scenarios are therefore plausible. And it's just very hard to see, even if there were clearer wording in the Lisbon Treaty, it's very hard to see the European Parliament election results, which look like being very fragmented anyway, as it is, to feeding directly into giving us any clear indication of who's the president and the political stripe of the president of the Commission is going to be, with so many other considerations to balance. It's really, the whole thing is looking so opaque and Byzantine at the moment, and there will be blood on the carpet before all these issues are settled. I suspect finally settled till October, possibly early November. Even though I'm sure there'll be determined efforts not to discredit the EU any longer than is needed by prolonging this negotiation longer than needs be. So I think there will be a serious effort in June, July to try to get these issues sorted. But I would be very surprised if they're all resolved before everyone disappears for the summer.
Right. Well, in Brussels. I can see many hands in the audience. I just remind you that it took 550 40 days to find a Belgian Prime Minister last time around. You caught my eye there at the back. Is there a roving microphone? Yes. And please can you identify yourselves, keep your question short, and perhaps identify an individual. Oh, well, OK, let's start with Dick. Then.
My name is Dick Leonard. I used to do your job, John, but that was a long time ago. I'd like to ask a question of Stuart Wheeler, who talked to us in very modest, moderate, and measured tones, and I'm sure I'm not the only person in the audience who saw a great contrast between this and the series of advertisements which UKIP have displayed during the last week. Some people have questioned whether there are racist undertones to some of these advertisements, but I'm concerned with the one that claims that 75% of legislation passed by the House of Commons originates from Brussels. This claim has been subjected to analysis by a very independent group of people, the research staff of the House of Commons, and their conclusion is that the proportion of legislation is in fact not much more than 6%, but if one includes statutory instruments, it may go up to 14%, but not beyond that. What I'd like to ask Mr. Wheeler is, what is his evidence for the claim made in the advertisement? And if he finds that he hasn't got any evidence, would he do something to ensure the withdrawal of these advertisements?
Did you get the question? It's about the claim that 75% of legislation comes from Brussels. Dick is saying it's either 6 or 14. I have a feeling when Dennis looked into this, the number could have been as much as 50 in certain interpretations, but not 75.
Well, I don't care what the figure is. It's very difficult. It depends. It depends how you define it. I mean, certainly the Germans themselves have said it's about 85%, I think. Somebody else has said it's about 70%. It's an enormous amount that comes from Brussels. There's no doubt about that. The idea of 6 or 10%, I can't produce the exact arguments, but I'm sure that's absolute nonsense. It's hardly been put forward until, I think, Clegg put it forward in the debate, which I'm happy to say he lost very convincingly, so he apparently didn't convince many people about that. An enormous amount of legislation, some primary, some not, comes from Brussels. What the exact figure is, I shouldn't say I don't care, but I know it's very high, and that's the only point I was making.
Well, is this on the same point? Dennis, why don't we stop with Dennis and then I'll come back to you.
Dennis McShane, the House of Commons consistently over any number of years, Stuart, and I'll speak loudly so you can hear me, says that never more than 7, maybe 8% of primary legislation emanates from Brussels. Now, there are certainly lots of technical things. You're quite right. I'm sure there's some Brussels rule that says you can't spread horseshit all over the local cricket green where you live. That's a terrible thing, but some of us have to stand up against horseshit. There are these technical rules. Yes, there are a number of those, but it is 7% of primary legislation. Get that into everybody's head. Now, Trevert, in softer tone to parliamentary questions, I thought Sarah's presentation and stats were fascinating. What they show is that out of the 751 seats, about 500 are likely to go to mainstreamish parties. And could we de-escalate the idea of an extremist surge taking over Europe? This is a very Anglo-Saxon English discussion. It couldn't happen in any other country because every other country has lived with anti-system parties. They were called communist parties for years. Separatist parties like the Catalonian Party, the Northern League. Within the anti-system parties, huge differences between a nominal left like Syriza and Jobbik in Hungary, openly anti-Semitic. Mr. Farage, and I agree with him on that, says he will not form an alliance with Marine Le Pen because, quotes, anti-Semitism remains embedded in the Front National, which I think actually is right, certainly as long as Jean-Marie Le Pen is there. Anyway, I think this is grossly exaggerated, that there's a huge revolutionary change. I will be interested to see whether either Juncker or Schulz get as far as being president of the commission. Schulz has to pass the test of being nominated by Mrs. Merkel, and his party only got 26% of the votes last September. Why should she nominate a loser from a party of losers to be the German commissioner? And that's a sine qua non to become president of the commission. There are plenty of other left candidates. I like Martin. Juncker, a bit different. He's a very big chain smoker, and he's a very thirsty man. Now, you know, our greatest Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, was both thirsty and a chain smoker, so who knows? Perhaps Juncker's got the required qualifications. I also think this will happen much faster, Morris, than we imagine. I don't think there's any appetite for this dragging on and on and on. And there's a huge number of jobs to be had. There's four presidents, Commission Council, President of the Parliament, President of the Eurogroup, High Representative or Foreign Minister, 28 committee chairmen. Look, there are jobs for all the boys and all the girls, and it all can be done quite quickly. And we're going to wake up with by June the 1st or June the 5th, the European Parliament for the first time is meeting immediately after the election, which had been pulled back a month. Sorry, this is techie stuff, but it is important. So the European Parliament can meet in June and July, not wait till the autumn. And I think this is going to rattle forward. Britain is completely out of it. We're going to find a monolingual has-been reject from the mainstream Conservative cabinet who's going to be sent as our commissioner. I think it's a very good idea to keep Cathy Ashton there for another 5 years. She won't want it because she's exhausted, but she's actually started badly, finished brilliantly, is a woman, and William Hague adores her. So there we are. Good arguments to keep Cathy. Finally, sorry, I'm coming just to this, just exactly to the end. The real question will not be a squabble between Jobbik, Marine Le Pen, Geert Wilders, Tsipras from Syriza, and the rest of them. They will squabble and squabble and squabble like mad, and none of them have got the eloquence of Danny Cohn-Bendit, so the European Parliament's going to be very boring for the next 5 years. We will wake up to the Brexit question, because UKIP are going to do jolly well on May the 22nd, and that's going to force that into the heart of British politics up to May 2015 and thereafter. Another set of questions for another debate, Morris and John. Believe me, the European debate won't be what happens in the European Parliament. The European debate in the next 3 or 4 years will be whether Britain stays in. So gird your loins, ladies and gentlemen. Stuart, spend your money. Believe me, the game has only just begun.
Thank you for the question.
It's going to be tricky for you to summarise that short question.
Well, actually, Sarah wanted to comment on the... Sarah wanted to comment on the numbers, and then I'm going to come to you.
Well, no, I just wanted to come back on one point, which is that whether or not to worry about the rise of the both individual candidates and groups on the fringes. And I think that we shouldn't at all just dismiss this as a UK debate. It's not a UK debate, it's a Europe-wide debate. And I think that not so much the numbers here, but what has been mentioned before regarding the turnout, those two things combined, the low turnout that we will still expect for these elections, as well as the outcome as we see it here, they are worrying signs. And of course it's not about the European elections only. This is general trend in democracies at the moment, in national politics as well. It's just much more pronounced in the European elections. But I wanted to point out that now we've mentioned the voter turnout several times, within that we have an even bigger problem, which is that it's a very much a generational problem. So the low voter turnout is especially pronounced with younger voters. We have a whole generation growing up to not take part in democracy and not take part in Europe and the debates about Europe's future. And I think that those issues is certainly not something we should dismiss as, you know, the mainstream parties are still there, they will still dominate the legislative agenda, because there's so much else that also matters in politics than just the legislative expertise of the people we elect.
I agree. I think 200 out of 700 is a very big number. Up there. And then there, and then there, and then there.
Thank you very much. My name is Michael Wells. This is a comment following up to support what Mark Leonard said about reasons to stay in the European Union and what's at stake, which nobody else has mentioned, and to say I hope that nobody in this room would vote for UKIP. For reasons that haven't been, I do have a question for Stuart Weeder. Nobody has mentioned culture or history. I mean, 2014 is the 300th anniversary of the Hanoverian succession in this country, which brought a German-speaking king here who didn't speak English. So the idea that for hundreds of years Britain or the United Kingdom has ruled itself in splendid isolation is, as Dennis McShane said, horseshit. We have a shared culture, language and history, and UKIP doesn't tell us about that. UKIP doesn't really tell us what they think the United Kingdom is. So we need to stay in Europe. We've had, since the Second World War, my grandfather's only brother was killed in the First War. Both my parents served in the Second War, and since the end of the Second World War, we have had unprecedented peace and stability in the European continent, and in part, not the whole, in part that is due to the European Union. The true British approach is to engage with our continental partners and work with them. And I think my question to Stuart Wheeler is, the people, your UKIP representatives who will undoubtedly get voted to the European Parliament, are they going to behave like they've been behaving for the last 5 years, that they take European money cynically, hypocritically, to fund what people are now here calling the self-hating Parliament? I would say it's irresponsible to take money from an organisation that you don't believe in. Your MEPs are lazy and they're incompetent. They don't go, they don't engage. It's a lost vote to vote for UKIP.
The comment was about Britain being part of Europe by history and culture and having a German royal family. The question was, will UKIP MEPs continue to take money from the European Parliament in a cynical way and not do a good job in Strasbourg? That was essentially the question.
It's not at all cynical, in my view, to take money from an organisation you disapprove of. The more we can get back into this country from the far too much money which we pay over to the European Union, the better. And what do they do with the money that they have got? Their accounts haven't been passed for 18 years. Any company in this country would be out of business if it behaved as the Europeans do, and about 5% of what they spend is lost by fraud. So I don't think it's at all a bad idea to take some of that money back into this country.
All right. There was one over there, then I'm going to go over here.
Thanks very much. I'm Sarah Ludford. I'm Liberal Democrat MEP for London. Yeah. I'm sorry you haven't heard a Liberal Democrat voice. I believe that Min Campbell had to pull out. I'm delighted to have heard Mark Leonard. I'm afraid I don't think he's a Liberal Democrat, but he made a very good case with which I fully agreed and very competently demolished the UKIP position. And I fully agree with the comments made there. And I do want to say, I'm afraid our chairman was rather quick that when Professor Fraser said that there was an expert revising a chamber in the European Parliament, and the chairman quipped, well, I'm glad the Parliament is good for something. Well, that is actually our job. We have the power to co-decide almost all legislation now, and the detail matters. And the fact that you have these non-performing passengers in the Parliament just means there's more work for everybody else. And if it isn't done competently, then I think that is a loss, and it is a disrespect, frankly, to the voters for indeed purporting to take part in a system to which you add absolutely nothing. I'm worry about the assuming, which I hope, that I will still be in the Parliament post May the 22nd, that there will be this tendency towards a sort of fudge across the mainstream groups. in the 15 years I've been in the Parliament that you've been able to get some progressive positions. I would say this, wouldn't I? But often with the Liberal group, if it worked with the left, we'd get progressive results on civil liberties. And if we worked with the right, we'd get progressive results on free trade, on structural reforms. I'm very worried about the prospect for TTIP. I agree with that. And the tendency, if you have this 25-30% of spoilers, really, is that you will get a lowest common denominator type of result in the Parliament, which I think will be very regrettable. Last remark. Again, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think Vote Watch is forecast a 62 for the ALDE group, underestimates new parties in some member states. You're only going on the results for delegations, national delegations, which are represented in the current parliament. You're not looking at new forces, I think, in like in France, where there are new developments. So I think your forecast is an underestimate.
So ALDE will do better than we expect. Do you want to make any comment on that?
I think that there is little doubt that the ALDE group as a whole will probably see some seats disappear, certainly. Of course, there's a margin of error around the estimates, and we've done this now for... Simon Hicks has done this now for, I think, the last 4 or 5 elections, and he's tried to adjust for the bias we know from a number of countries. What has been the problem in the last 2 weeks has been that we've seen a few countries where parties all of a sudden split, and a few countries where parties all of a sudden joined together, also within the ALDE group. So there is some uncertainty, but the loss of 23 seats that's a conservative estimate. So I think that it's true to think that the squeezed middle will certainly be very squeezed for the ALDE group.
Over here, and then we've got two in the middle.
As a member of the public, I'm quite confused. Could the members of the panel just recommend me a simple book or article which I will learn the pros and cons of being in the EU with the correct statistics and the possibilities, please?
Mark? There are two books that have just come out, which I wish. Don't you take my book. There's one by Hugo Dixon, which is called The In-Out Question, and there's one by David Charter, the former Times correspondent, which I think may also be called The In-Out Question or something rather similar, Britain In or Out. And the Charter book has quite a lot of quite good numbers in it. So I don't know whether anybody else has seen that.
So I'll do better than that. If you give me your card or tell me your address at the end of this, I'll send you a couple of books which will make everything completely clear to you. If you like, one of the books I've got with me here contains innumerable statistics. So, if that's what you're after, I've got it here right now.
You know that there are lies, damned lies, and statistics in the middle, and then.
Sarah Hobel, I'm a professor here at the European Institute. So just to go back to the question of what's at stake and John Pete's question of these candidates, because I think when they were first advertised, the idea of having candidates running for the European Commission, the idea was partly to give European voters a choice, not just about whether to vote for the anti-establishment or whether to vote for the mainstream, but also to give them a real choice between different kinds of mainstream. So whether you want, you know, a growth Europe or austerity Europe, so between the left and the right, to create that kind of politics at the European level. And I tuned into this first debate, and my husband was like, what are you watching, some Eurovision from the 80s? And I think I was probably, you know, I could hardly sit through the 90 minutes, and I think not many did. But I think also your comments about how this candidate of the Commission is ultimately going to be selected to be president really reveals that regardless of what voters do vote for, you know, whether they vote for the red bloc or the blue bloc, that's not really going to matter that much, because it's really a sort of, they're going to sit and do some backroom deal. We want a woman, we want a North European, a Southern European, we want someone from the left, someone from the right. So I guess, isn't it entirely rational for voters to either say, you know, okay, we go to the anti-establishment, but in terms of to say, why does this really matter for us? If we want the mainstream, what kind of choice do we have? So isn't it failed, certainly in this election, this experiment of trying to create a real link between a different sort of mainstream choice and the right and the left, and a particular policy of the Commission, a particular agenda for the Commission, the Executive, and potentially also for the Parliament? I mean, I certainly don't see it coming through in these debates or in the media coverage of it, that I, as a sort of normal voter, would know, okay, if I vote for the Socialist or Labour in this country, I'm going to get this, I'm going to get Schulz. If the Socialists win, will I know that's the case? I would think probably not.
Mark, you might comment on that. I mean, one of the problems, as it seems to me as a journalist, is to draw a distinction between Juncker, Schulz and Verhofstadt is very difficult. They all basically believe in the same things.
I mean, in a way, they make the argument that Stuart and the other sort of anti-establishment parties are making, which is, you know, it's the old kind of anarchist thing, left or right, it doesn't matter, the government will win. And here it's the kind of EU institutions. All three of those candidates have basically come from the European Parliament or from the European Council. They're inside the Beltway. They have very little. There are three or four countries where the election will be about Schulz versus Juncker. Luxembourg is one of them. Germany is another, because they all speak German and there are going to be televised debates. I mean, it might not be the most important thing that Germans vote on, but it would not be totally ridiculous to claim that played a part in the election after you've had televised debates between the different candidates. But I'm not actually, maybe it's just two countries. I'm not sure if there are other countries that are running televised debates with all these candidates and with them. Maybe Austria, because it does seem to be. Sorry? Yeah, okay. So four countries out of the 28, there are these debates. But the big problem is that, you know, rather than being like a sort of system of open primaries, or, you know, the US system where you can throw up an Obama or other exciting people, nobody who's in power anywhere wanted to take the risk of putting their name forward. So that ruled out all of the professional politicians in the different countries, which basically meant that you were left with people sitting in the European Parliament or the European Commission, who are, in most people's minds, part of the problem rather than part of the solution. If you want to have a choice which is not the status quo, then you would need people to come from national politics or from outside of politics who could actually mobilise people. And so therefore, in a way, those debates between them is a sort of an advert for what's wrong with the status quo. And to the extent that anyone watches them, I think they will encourage people to vote for anti-establishment parties. But for that reason, I don't. As I said, in at least 24 member states, you won't see any reference to either Schulz or Juncker or Verhofstadt or anything inside the party literature that goes out on people's doorsteps. They're not speaking at rallies. They're not being mentioned in different places. It is a difficult question, though, because, you know, if we were playing sort of fantasy politics, there are not that many European candidates that have box office appeal outside of their member states, which is the part of the core problem. We don't have a single language with which we can, in which you can campaign. Apart from Angela Merkel, there are, I think, very few people who either attract positive or negative feelings in member states outside of their own. And it's difficult to see how you could actually, in the current circumstances, have a real debate. I mean, Tony Blair, I think, was another person who attracted, you know, maybe a lot of people don't like him in a lot of countries, but at least they'd recognise him. But that's not true of most of the leaders of different European countries. And even if someone were elected, I actually think conflict is a good thing, and that's actually how you make decisions and how you interest people. But there is a danger that If you did have a clear, strong political platform being adopted by the next European Commission, next EU institution, that could actually lead to the breakup of the European Union. In the same way that Scots, when they have long periods of Tory rule, start to question whether they want to be in a European, in a United Kingdom, which is always voting for Conservative governments that they don't support themselves and experimenting with the poll tax and things like that on them. You could see that if you have, you know, a majority of people in Britain voting for the Labour Party and a majority of Europeans voting for a centre-right party, that would over time create real tensions within the EU, which is why maybe a mushy compromise is seen as the least, the lesser of the two evils.
Yeah. Do you want to add anything, Maurice?
Yes, I will. I think we political anoraks have to be very careful not to assume that voters are going to be poring over differences between party manifestos, taking a view on the comparative merits on particular leaders of the present European Commission and so on. It's so easy to just, you know, we spend so much time analysing this, the desirability of this, talking about it and so on. The fact is that most people who vote, those who actually do go out to vote, will be uploading their normal political preferences, which they normally express or think about in their domestic context, and will be voting tribally according to their normal preferences, but not really actually engaging with all the, you're taking a view on European issues. That's sort of slightly separate from the general point that most people are going to be voting in terms of what they think of their government rather than EU issues. The point is that it is normal to upload your preferences at even a European Parliament election from your normal national preference. If I may, very, very quickly, John, just one other point, because there's something I really have to take this opportunity to put to Stuart, because it's never, since we've gone off topic, we're talking about the desirability of leaving the EU and so on. One simple argument that has not been made by the pro-EU lobby, and I do not understand why it hasn't made, is simply this. It is the absurdity of the "with one bound we're free" argument. The fact of the matter is that if we want to go on trading with our partners, and you're saying our partners will surely want to continue trading with us, Stuart, if we want, we still have to live with and accept EU law, including the compliance costs that arise out of that. We still have to the classic example and the greatest education. We might come back to that. The great education for the Americans on this was when, to the absolute astonishment and horror of U.S. President, 15 years ago now, two U.S. corporate giants, GE and Honeywell, were unable to merge because it was in breach of EU competition law. And Americans say, "What are you talking about?" They couldn't believe this. I mean, they went apoplectic. But they had to accept that, to actually understand what the EU is. EU competition law, we have to comply with. This notion that we can somehow be rid of all these costs and compliance things is just nonsense.
I think if we'll come back to that at the end. I'm going to give everybody 1 minute at the end, and I've got three more questions, and we've only got 10 minutes. So I'm proposing to take three, and that doesn't mean three now, in a row, starting here. Very briefly.
Paul McGrail, Catholic Workers Group, just touch on briefly on what Professor Fraser just said. For UKIP to use Switzerland and Norway as examples of people who can live outside is just insane. Those two countries have nothing whatever in common with the UK. My question is, will the next European Parliament have any input into any possible amendments that the Conservatives were to win, and David Cameron renegotiates Britain's status as per the Lisbon Treaty, would the Parliament have any approval of that?
They have to approve any treaty, which would include a treaty. But we'll come back to that in a moment. Over here.
Yes, my name is Maggie Ellis. I'm the senior research fellow here. I want to make three quick points. I'm very worried about the misunderstanding about horseshit, because it's a very serious scientific fact that in the days when we were allowed to disband it anywhere we wanted, there was far more illness and disease in other animals and in human beings. And if a wife doesn't appreciate that, then I'm worried about her having horses. The whole thing about standards and regulation frequently emanate from this country. What happens is when it gets back from Brussels, there are people in Whitehall who implement the regulation plus 20. And they are very good at making jobs for little Hitlers in Whitehall that then implement not the laws that were made in Brussels, but the laws that have been made and misinterpreted in Whitehall. And that is a big problem. Second point I want to make, I spend a lot of time in Scotland. We would not be having a lot of this crazy discussion in Scotland, because Scotland on the whole is in favour of the European Union. They're longing to be part of it. I think that the Whitehall government has a lot to be responsible for not making a clear picture. We have a good example this evening. We have a member of the coalition not turning up to this debate. It's an endless picture when ministers do not turn up to things at London School of Economics nor anywhere else to represent the government opinion. But the last thing I want to make, and I do hope you'll take your message back to UKIP. I and a group of my colleagues this year, this calendar year, have gained over 500,000 from Brussels to do research. That means we will have jobs, we will have work, we will have education, training, skills and ability. And that is a very important feature. But last of all, we will have implementation and trade. And if that isn't important to the United Kingdom, I don't know what is.
Well, okay, sorry. I'm going to take one more question, then I'm going to go again very briefly, because we are running out of time.
Thank you. Richard Crowder, I work in the Foreign Office, so that's a department in Whitehall, I'm afraid. But I've just a quick question. I've been interested by what people have said about protectionism and free trade agreements and TTIP and so on. So it's really a question for both Mark and Stuart. I mean, if our premise is there's a drift towards greater protectionism in the EU, then I guess my question to Mark is, what is our confidence that in staying in the EU we can continue as the UK to pursue an agenda of free trade and conclude agreements with the United States and other countries? But I guess the flip side of that is the question to Stuart about if we were to leave the EU, what is our confidence that we could negotiate terms to continue access to the single market? I take your point about the amount of trade in both directions, but as a proportion of the continental European economy, that's much smaller than the trade represents as a proportion of the UK economy to the continent.
I'm going to give the floor first to Stuart. I think the two questions that I think you need to answer from those comments, one is that the European Union is a very important source of research money and other money that helps. The second question is this one: if the UK is not part of the EU as you would desire, security? How can you be sure that the UK will be able to pull its weight in trade negotiations with the US, with China, with India, when it's a very small country dealing with a rather large giant? It would lose trading weight.
As to getting money from Europe, maybe they have given 500,000 to a good cause which you believe in. That's fine. But the point is that we give them 20 billion a year, and if they give us 10 billion back, which is about what they do, they're only giving half back of the money we've given to them. If we didn't give 20 billion to them, we'd have twice as much to be able to give to your cause. Now, so the other point was...
The other point was about trade. Negotiating trade deals with America.
But one thing, the only people who can negotiate on trade for the moment on our behalf is the EU. And very, very frequently, the interests of the other members of the EU are not the same as our interest. We are not allowed at the moment, because we are in the EU, we are not allowed to even be there when negotiations with the World Trade Organization take place. As soon as we were out, we would get back our rightful seat there and have influence there. We don't have any influence. We have 8% of the votes in the EU, and they don't like us anyway, on the whole. We would have far more influence in any kind of trade negotiations if we were out of the EU and took our seat at the World Trade Organization.
Well, we do. I mean, let me just pursue that for 2 seconds. I mean, I do find this argument from UKIP. I hear what UKIP are saying, which is that in the European Union, we have no influence at all. And yet they say when we leave the European Union, suddenly we will have enormous influence, which strikes me as rather inconsistent. If we are an influential country, why can we not be influential inside the European Union?
Because we only have 8% of the votes there, whereas people listen to us in the World Trade Organization just as they listen to everybody else.
Let's go, Mark. What do you want to comment on?
Well, I was asked that direct question on trade, and I think if you look at other countries with roughly our population around the world, none of them have managed to negotiate the sorts of deep free trade agreements that the EU has managed to negotiate with other powers. Turkey, for example, has signed lots of free trade agreements with everybody, but they're very shallow and they don't deal with most of the non-tariff barriers which open markets to us. And the idea that a country like China is going to talk to us on equal terms when we're getting access to 1.4 billion consumers from them and they're getting access to 60 million consumers from us is absolutely laughable. We've got a much better chance of convincing the French, the Germans and other member states in the European Union who have a relatively similar economic interests to us to agree on a common platform which we can then take to Beijing to prize open the Chinese market when we are their biggest export market than we would do going there with a relatively small market trying to get access to a huge market. You know, it's not rocket science to see that our opportunities to trade are going to be far diminished if we go offering tiny markets to other people.
They're not going to be diminished whatever. At the moment, we cannot make a trade deal with any other country in the world because only the EU is allowed to do it. And we want to make trade deals with other countries in the world. And China has made a trade deal with Iceland. So you don't have to be big to get a deal with China.
So let me give the floor to Morris now.
I would be basically, just restate pretty much what I agree with what Mark said. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's, I mean, where does one start? But anyway, I'll keep my peace in this.
Can I have one question? What role the new European Parliament would play in a new treaty as Cameron would like?
Well, I mean, that's very difficult to predict. It seems that, broadly speaking, at the moment, there is a narrow, let's say, for want of a better term, liberal majority in the Parliament. The Parliament will always have its concerns about certain environmental matters, consumer matters, and so on. But broadly speaking, the Parliament would have a narrow liberal majority, which would extend, incidentally, beyond the centre-right and the Liberals, but actually some social democratic parties as well. It's not, I mean, still the PES would have to take an overall view on any trade deal, including with the United States, and that would be interesting. Interesting how that pans out, but I suspect that the mainstream centre-left parties, the PES, would go along with a deal which, to their mind, safeguarded some of their concerns. It's very hard to see, though, the new Parliament in a few weeks' time being as liberal. On any prediction, I just do not see how it's going to be as liberal. And that is, I think, a big concern, not just for the UK, but for many countries, certainly Central East European countries, most certainly the Scandinavian countries. And that's not good news. That is not good news. And it actually feeds into not eventually a potential a vote on a TTIP negotiation, but into negotiation of association agreement. agreements, trade agreements with other countries as well, and into the mandate, which is agreed in the Council, for the Commission as it goes off to Geneva to negotiate in the WTO. The point is that if some national governments start to take fright at a populist surge in the Parliament, are they going to feel that the better part of valour is discretion, or are they just going to feel intimidated enough to actually take the populist line and go for protectionism? The effects of the European Parliament elections will, of course, reverberate well beyond votes in the Parliament, and will be part of the backdrop, the noise, against which national governments are going to have to define the position that they take in the Council. But all the pressures would seem to... I mean, so far, considering we've been the depth of the economic crisis we've been going through since 2008, the EU has been pretty good at resisting the siren voices of protectionism. Not in all cases, but on the whole, it's been pretty good. And at national level, a few member states have been pushing for a much more protectionist line. That is going to come under serious challenge now, I suspect, I mean, on all the readings of the likely outcomes of the election. So we need to be careful.
Sarah. Yeah, I think I might just make two comments here. One being the non-Brit on the panel, that I don't know if it's very rude to put it this way, but certainly the UK is not unique in all of this, and the debate here is always putting the uniqueness of the UK vis-à-vis the rest of Europe into a very isolationist debate. And I think that it's a shame that the debate domestically is coloured in that way, because we certainly see a lot of the concerns that are expressed in the opinion polls in the UK reflect in a number of other countries. Also in terms of government policies and government preferences, I'm from Denmark, there's certainly a lot of Danish interest in what goes on in the UK, both in the government's policies as well as in the opinion polls, simply because the UK is the big country that could lead on a number of very important liberal progressive issues that a country like Denmark certainly would follow. Denmark is a very small example, but there are many more in both Eastern Europe, there are, the Czech Republic, Poland, etc., that would certainly be very much interested in having UK pursue the policies that they also see as being important to them. In the Netherlands right now, we have campaigns. We actually have European campaigns in the run-up to the European election, so you will see the billboards where you have slogans that shows the scepticism, but also suggestions for progressive EU policies, so EU-level policies that the UK certainly would agree with. So I think that here, observing the debate this time around for the European elections, I think it's very inward-looking in the UK, and I think that it would be interesting, obviously, to see with the results now what happens, but also what the reaction to the UK results will be in other countries. The other thing I think I might just finish off on is the wider perspective of where what the new Parliament will actually, the environment it will operate within. And I think that apart from the very big questions that the governments will have to decide on and which the Parliament will have some role to play in as well, banking union, further integration in financial sector, etc. All of those things are extremely important also for the Parliament's position in the institutional balance. And just to mention that right now we've seen all the permanent representatives now have a number of people in the Danish representation. We never had any person dealing with the Parliament before. We now have 8. In the UK, in the German perm rep, we have, I think it's close to 20 that actually deal with inter-institutional matters. The Parliament is taken very seriously. And I think that this is a trend that we see in Brussels, that the legislature, as was pointed out by Sarah Ludlow, that the Parliament plays a very important role, and the Council is adjusting to the Parliament's increased powers and its increased expertise. And this is important also in terms of the accountability that voters certainly voice concerns about in the European elections now. We see there's pressure on the council and the governments on how decisions are made there, and I think that the parliament in many, many ways will play a defining role for how that goes forward and how also with relations to national parliament scrutiny happens of government's decisions at the EU level.
Okay, well, I think we are out of time, so I think I will... Would you want to say one more thing, Stuart?
I'm going to reply to 6 points made against me. First, I never said simply that the EU is not perfect. The point about it is that it's incompetent, fraudulent, and costs us a fortune. Second, Norway and Switzerland have been mentioned. They are the only two countries in Europe which are not in the EU, and as it happens, they are the first and second most prosperous countries in the whole area. Third, how awful to be alone. What about Hong Kong and what about Singapore? Both tiny countries do terribly well alone. Thirdly, social protection was mentioned. It is social protection, the desire to protect its employees, particularly in France, for example, which leads to widespread unemployment in France because no one will take anyone on because of the difficulty of getting rid of them. Fourth, climate change was mentioned. Let me just point out there has been no global warming for 17 years and the legislation, there has been none, it's not in dispute. And the legislation to deal with that here is making our electricity very, very much more expensive. Thirdly, the fact that we would have to comply, with competition law if we want to do something in competition in France, well, of course we would. So would any two countries in the world. It's a non-point.
You're right. Okay, I think we are going to run out of time. We have run out of time. So I'd just like to thank the panel, and I hope you enjoyed some of this evening.